Welcome to the Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. Is the union slipping between our fingers? Polls show that the anti-independence vote is in the lead, but only just, and only thanks to fears that freedom might be financially costly. We ask Alistair Darling if it's time to make a more romantic case for the union and for the brotherhood between our two great countries. Also, Mao Zedong and a Chinese invasion of Britain that never happened. We discuss the cult-like behaviour of some of those on Britain's fringe far left. The latest opinion polling paints an unclear picture about Scotland's future. On the question of independence, the likely no vote currently stands at 47% and the yes vote at 38%. A 9-point lead in favour of the union that the nationalists say they can overcome with just a 5-point swing. They're trying to do that by playing softly, softly, talking not about Braveheart or Scottish identity, but instead about the welfare goodies that would flow if Scotland was free. And, in kind, the unionist campaign has been content to fight back on the basis of the material costs of Scotland going it alone, saying that there would be issues of EU membership, debt and spending. But does this pocketbook-style campaign work to the nationalist advantage? After all, polls also show that Scottish people overwhelmingly prefer to define themselves as Scottish rather than British. Does a lack of romance in the union campaign risk allowing independence to happen almost by default? Earlier today, I spoke to Alistair Darling and Benedict Brogan. And by the way, a last-minute technical glitch means it sounds like I'm in a hotel lobby. I started by asking Mr. Darling what he thought his chances were of winning the campaign.
Well, I think we can win, but there are a very large number of people who are undecided. Scotland has an electorate of about 4 million, about a million people we think could be swayed either way. And you're right, the argument here is partly arguments of the head, the economy, which, like every other electoral contest, is dominant. But it's also something bigger than that. It is a romantic argument, an argument of the heart. But, of course, that pulls both ways. The nationalists have got their tunes they want to play equally from our side. You know, our argument about being better and stronger together has a lot to do with the fact that although we are fiercely proud of being Scottish or living in Scotland, at the same time, we are part of a bigger world.
What do you think are going to be the main points that are going to win over the undecideds? What are the things you think people are going to really be thinking about on the day?
Well, I think the big thing, actually, if you look at the undecideds, is they are attracted to the proposition that decisions should be taken in Scotland, but they also have huge doubts about being asked to take a leap in the dark. You know, they're not convinced by the economics. They're not convinced that they would actually be better off, and indeed, a lot of people worry they're going to be actually worse off. I suppose the answer to that is that in many ways in Scotland we have the best of both worlds. You have a Scottish Parliament that decides on health, education, transport and so on. And at the same time we've got a much bigger market which Scottish firms, especially the financial services industry, sell most of their products south of the border. So people can see both these arguments and when they're put in that way, the evidence so far is that undecided group is more leaning towards being part of the United Kingdom than leading towards independence. But as I say, that's a pretty fluid situation at the moment, and you'd be very complacent indeed if you thought that the thing was anything like decided or won at the moment.
OK, Benedict Brogan, who I believe is Scottish by birth. Is that correct?
Correct.
That is correct. Do you agree with that analysis?
I think Alice is right. I think there is there are a great deal of undecided voters out there, and I think the thing that is striking is perhaps the touch of complacency among some of those who are supporters of the union, who think that because the polls have always shown that the union has the advantage, that it's all going to be all right on the night. The fact is that I think things are far more finely balanced than that. And at that point, we start discussing how the debate is run, what is the argument, is an economic argument too dry, and what voices do we hear in the argument? I think one of the things that is most interesting about the campaign in favour of the union is the whole question of what are legitimate voices in that debate. To what extent should it be Scottish voices leading the argument in favour of the union? To what extent do English voices have legitimacy in that debate, or are they counterproductive? I think David Cameron and George Osborne, for example, are well aware that while they are fully supportive of the union, their voices, when deployed in Scotland, aren't necessarily helpful.
But isn't that rather unhealthy that the debate just becomes about Scottish people talking to Scottish people, because the union is all of us?
You know, I just from what Ben was saying there, I think it is important that we have voices both sides of the border. I suppose it really depends on what people are saying and in many ways how they say it. You know, frankly, someone coming up to Scotland and hectoring, you know, that's never going to work. I think the view the Prime Minister has taken has been entirely right, and he's saying, look, it's not for you in Scotland to decide what you want to do, but speaking from his point of view as an English Prime Minister, he says, I would rather the United Kingdom stayed intact, and I think people respect that view. But I think that there's something bigger here. I think it is terribly important to people living in Scotland that you know, the rest of the UK actually wants them to stay. And you know, I think voices coming from England, Wales, and Northern Ireland, you know, speaking in support of the United Kingdom is just now is very important. I think there's another argument too. If, frankly, this whole debate is run as a political spat between one bunch of politicians and another, people will turn off.
Yeah. Yeah, Ben.
The thing that I think Alice is absolutely right, but I think therefore we get into a danger area because so much of the debate is being reduced to an argument about money, often in the way many marriages, when they break up, end up being an argument about who gets what. And you get the impression that the case for the union is being made on the basis that Scotland would be worse off financially if it was not in the union. And the case for the union in England is one which is in danger of veering towards the English continuing to, as they see it, underwrite Scotland. There's something slightly unedifying about an argument about money. And what I wonder, and I think it'll be curious to hear from Alistair how the campaign is going to proceed, about what are the positive arguments, both in England and in Scotland, to, as he say, make the case for them staying together.
Bearing in mind, if I can just throw in before you answer, Mr. Darling, that I've noticed also that the Scottish nationalist case, the economic one, is that independence will lead to people having more money in their pocket, whereas the unionist case, so made so far, seems to actually be a sort of restrictionist one. It's about saying, no, that won't happen. Stay with us and we'll manage things better, but we're not offering you more.
Look, just arising from what Ben was saying there, I think in any contest, electoral contest, any sampling of opinion, the economy is the most dominant thing. You know, people do think, well, what's best for me, what's best for my family? And I think that both sides will naturally want to engage on that. But both of you are right in saying that you need something more than that. You know, being Scottish or being British, you know, it's so much more than your material well-being. It's a sense of what your country is about. It's a sense of our shared history. And actually, if you look at the UK, it's far more than the sum of its parts. You know, a Scotsman founded the BBC, an Englishman founded the Bank of Scotland, a Welshman founded the NHS. You know, we've got huge shared history, both in times of peace and times of conflict. And next year, of course, we'll be commemorating the outbreak of the First World War, in which tens of thousands of people from all parts of the country made the ultimate sacrifice. But if you looking forward, I think people have this sense in Scotland of, yes, we live in Scotland or we're Scottish, but there is something bigger. You know, there's a world out there that is much, much bigger. You know, it's fascinating that all the sampling that's done of 16 and 17-year-olds shows that, unlike the situation, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago, they are overwhelmingly pro the United Kingdom, or rather anti the Scotland leaving the United Kingdom. And my guess is, because an awful lot of them, they get their news, they're informed through their iPhones rather than through newspapers, and they're just seeing a different world. And there is a sense of what we are, you know, being British, being Scottish, being both, not having to choose between them. There's something far, far bigger than, you know, the natural concern that people have got about their jobs or the pound in their pocket.
Well, presumably the argument, Alistair, in favour of the union, if we're looking at the future, is that the union brings benefits both to Scotland and to England and is more than just a shared history that we feel somewhat fuzzy and warm about. Presumably in the 21st century, the argument must be that the union has tangible benefits to Scots, to Englishmen, to Welshmen and those in Northern Ireland that would not be available if Scotland was no longer part of the union.
Yeah, you know, the United Kingdom without any one part of it is not the United Kingdom that it was. And, you know, I think you're dead right that both in economic terms, but also in the sense of identity, you know, the UK is bigger than the sum of its constituent parts. So, yes, that sense of opportunity as well as security that comes from being part of the UK is a terribly important part of the argument.
But isn't the difficulty, though, that the young people who look at their iPhones, when you say to them, but we are better off together than we are apart, that we are a greater the sum of the part, you know, we are greater than the sum of our parts, they're entitled to say, well, what does that actually mean in practical terms? What is the reason for the union? What is the advantage? How do we benefit? And what I'm struck by is how so far we haven't yet found a language that starts to pin down what it is that we get out of it beyond a kind of vague feeling that we're better off together.
It's different, and it's also different for individuals, how they feel about the country in which they live. And remember, there's no getting away from this, that how people see their country today is very often judged by the things they see the government of the day, whatever it happens to be doing, what's happening in Scotland and the rest of the UK, what's happening in the world. That in many ways, shapes people's ideas of what we can do. But I think there is just a feeling, you know, and there's a majority at the moment, and hopefully that will be translated into support at the referendum, who just feel that they have their Scottish identity or their British identity or sometimes both of these things, but they also have a sense of what the country we can do as individuals and what we can do as a country within the United Kingdom in terms of, you know, jobs, improving life as we know it, but also a sense of what the UK can do, you know, through working internationally and, you know, on you know, things that range from helping tackle the lack of education or poverty in Africa to working through the United Nations, for example. So, you know, I think there's many different ways in which you touch people's thoughts and how you inspire them. It's not the same for all, but you're dead right, Ben. The language you employ in these things is pretty critical to that.
Okay, final question. Alistair, if, horror of horrors, Scotland votes for independence, what would you do? Where would you live? How would you define yourself?
I'll carry on living in Edinburgh, where I live at the moment.
And you'll regard yourself as Scottish, you'll be happy with independence, you'll accept it, and...
Well, look, I, being a good Democrat, I will abide by the outcome of the referendum, as everybody has to, which is, you know, what ought to concentrate the minds of people. Remember, this is a referendum which the Nationalists only need to win once by one vote, whatever the turnout. From my point of view, I think we need to win this, you know, fairly well if we're going to put this to bed for our generation. So, you know, there's a lot at stake here. You know, just on the Scottish and British point, I don't see why I've got to choose between them, and I don't see why I should be told to choose by anybody.
Alistair Darling and Benedict Brogan, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We've struggled to find the right words to describe what happened in South London to the people living in the care of Mr. Balakrishnan. First, it was called slavery. Now there's speculation, and it is only speculation, that it was something to do with a Maoist cell, a collective that Mr. Balakrishnan ran under the nom de plume of Comrade Bala, that taught that Britain was fascist and that China would invade in 1980 to liberate it from the squares. Certainly, some have said that the few details we have of the living conditions of the three women allegedly who escaped from Bala's control suggest something cult-like. There were no physical bounds as such, said the police, but, in the words of one of the women involved, they wore, quote, invisible handcuffs. So thinking about the wider issue of crazy groupthink, I want to talk about, first, how we define cults, and second, why you'll find them not just among UFO spotters and Jesus freaks, but also among the far-left remnants of the 1960s. Damian Thompson, you've literally written the book on the subject of cults and cult-like practice. What is a cult?
It's a very unsatisfactory word, I think. Particularly in the English language, and it's interesting that it doesn't have an exact equivalent in other European languages, which means that debating it all gets very complicated. We've got in the back of our minds a caricature of a cult. I think it really took shape in the 1970s, what with the Moonies and Jim Jones' mad leader, mind control, which I'd argue doesn't actually exist, but weird clothes, maybe, the looming shadow of mass suicide. And we've got it into our heads, I think, that the cults have all of these characteristics somehow or other. They'll tick all of those boxes. Actually, I think the essence of the phenomenon of a cult, and a sect as well, is a certain sort of power that's being wielded, what Max Weber called charismatic authority. It's essentially a sort of magical power. A leader or a group of people believe that they can bring about extraordinary transformations, whether they're political or whether they're religious, really through the force of their personality, their special powers, rather than the office they hold, though they may also hold office. I think Hitler, for example, is a good example of somebody who wielded charismatic authority but was also, of course, Chancellor of Germany. So it can be on a huge scale. You could say that the whole of North Korea is essentially a cult, if you like, which is dedicated to the magical powers of the Kim family. But it tends to happen on a very small scale because people claim special powers and find they don't win over very many people, but those people they do win over are utterly convinced, at least for the time being. The thing about this sort of authority is if you don't produce the results, then you're in trouble. And if you don't produce the results in a sort of sectarian milieu, whether it's religious or it's political, then people will split away and you get the famous splitters of Life of Brian.
Two things that you raised there, which somewhat surprised me. On the question of results, is it not the case that cults have an amazing ability to move the goalposts? So when something doesn't happen that was supposed to happen, they do have an ability, and this is what perhaps makes them somewhat unusual and out of the mainstream, to say, oh, I always knew it wasn't going to happen, or, oh, the prophecy has changed, or, oh, it did happen, you just haven't noticed.
They don't, I think, have any special ability to move the goalposts. What they do is move the goalposts, because effectively they're claiming that such and such an amazing thing may happen on a specific date. Mm. And normally in the run-up to that date, rather than after it fails to happen, they move the goalposts. But that's one of the sort of classic dynamic of the weakening of a cult. Once they start to move the goalposts, you'll notice that the followers drift away. And often it's a very traumatic experience. The Jehovah's Witnesses backed themselves into a corner, shall we say, predicting the end of the world in 1975. And when it didn't happen, they lost an enormous number of followers. So it's very traumatic. The other thing is the death of the prophet. How does it survive that? Christianity is an example of a cult, which it was seen as at the time, that did survive the death of the prophet.
Right.
Mostly they don't.
Which brings me on to my second point. When I says the word cult, I personally think of something quite small as a cell. And I was interested to hear you say that North Korea could be described as a cult. Is not what defines a cult in some ways its smallness, its introspection, and things that began as cults but go on to become mass movements, that's what defines them as not having been a cult.
Well, that's one...
Christianity was not a cult because history proved that it was a mass movement.
I mean, I'm emphasizing that the essence of cults is the sort of power that they exercise. That's the particular definition I'm using. There are 57 at least different definitions of cult, some of which concentrate on the smallness or the strangeness of the group, some of which concentrate on the power dynamics. But I think when I describe North Korea as a sort of gigantic cult, it does make sense.
Janet Daly.
It's the messianic nature of the leader which causes people to perceive reality in a different way. With the fact that you can actually affect people's perception of their own reality, that seems to be central to it, so much so that it can exceed the empirical evidence. So, for example, if it doesn't meet the deadline, you can somehow survive that because you can redefine the deadline or redefine the event, and the followers will come with you because they have allowed you to infiltrate their sense of reality.
Yes. Is part of it the lack of realistic probability? Because quite often with these cults, they tell people that something's going to happen that is simply beyond the realms of reasonableness that it's going to happen. And if you buy into that one thing, then you're willing to believe anything and you're willing to make any sacrifices. So, for example, if I don't want to talk too much about this particular case, but it seems as though this gentleman made a prediction that China would invade in 1980. It seems to me that if you're someone who's prepared to buy that prediction, then you're prepared to buy anything and you're prepared to surrender to any truth, no matter how crazy or distorted.
I don't know. I think that what you're being asked to believe would have to be somehow tenuously connected logically to the original proposition.
Right.
I mean, you can bend the original proposition, you can bend the principles, but I don't think you could say something absolutely other and expect many people. I mean, his cult obviously was very diminished when his prediction didn't come through. That's why he ended up with this tiny number of followers who were effectively imprisoned in a kind of Stockholm syndrome, whatever. It's not... if it becomes implausible in the sense that you're absolutely reversing the first premises that you began the cult with, then I think it breaks.
Yeah, and I have to say I disagree quite strongly with Tim's analysis of cults. I don't think that the, if you like, that the sociology of the cult is that much different from the sociology of other religious groups. It's just that the balance has changed, perhaps.
Well, and back of my mind, I am trying to make a distinction between...
Let's take the example of the Moonies. Well, you're making a distinction. Lots of people have abandoned, sociologists of religion have abandoned the word cult and refer to them as new religious movements precisely right. because it's such a quagmire. But if you take the example of the Moonies, it was in their early days, in the 50s and in the 60s, that they built... the cult of their leader around the notion that the world was going to end. And they made very specific predictions, and then they backed away from them because they simply weren't winning enough converts. And the time of the Moonies' greatest flourishing, the 1970s, was an era by which point they'd tidied up and rationalized and acclimatized their messianic prophecies to the wider religious environment.
Right.
And that's actually when they were at their most controversial, because they became really visible.
So they had reined in on some of that improbability.
Yes. I mean, I think you have to say, if you're going to single out this word cult, you are going to also have to start locating it in unexpected religious environments, such as, for example, a Benedictine monastery can be run in a cult-like fashion. You will often find spiritual gurus within the Catholic Church, or within the Orthodox Church, or within Protestantism,
who wield a special
sort of authority,
yes.
and who make predictions, and who then fail. So many cult-like groups have emanated from
yes.
the larger religious organizations. For example, Opus Dei is in many respects a cult-like group. It goes through periods when it is stranger than
yeah.
it is at others.
But of course, ultimately,
there's a dividing line between Orthodox religion
and cult.
But
I think there very much is. Make my point. They sort of detach from the mothership when they become a cult. But at the beginning, they are within the context of Orthodoxy and tradition. But when they become a cult, they detach and break away.
Okay, well, the Unification Church was, you know, effectively detached from the mothership of a very well-established type of Christian, Korean Christianity. So many groups that we think of as cults, like the Branch Davidians, detached from the Seventh-day Adventists.
Yeah.
There are many very, very strange quasi-Catholic groups out there, some of them utterly bizarre, racist and survivalist in their theology, which emanated from the traditionalist branches of the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah.
So I don't accept this dichotomy.
Which brings us onto the subject of splitters and the far left. Janet Daly, who once was very left-wing yourself and moved in this particular milieu, so you can testify to this. This kind of cult-like behaviour is not exclusively about religion. It's not exclusively about alien obsession or anything. It is found on the far left. And in fact, the far left in some ways is fertile territory for cult-like behaviour.
Marxist ideology is not at all unlike theology in this significant respect, and I don't mean that disparagingly to either theology or Marxist ideology. It gives you a comprehensive understanding of how the world works. It seems to offer a complete analysis. Particularly young, conscientious, intelligent people always ask, there are universal questions, you know, why do the innocent suffer? What does it mean to lead a good life? How can we see to it that every human being has a chance of happiness? All of these questions are asked by almost all sort of conscientious young people. And Marxism, like theology, gives you a set of answers. And it gives you an analysis which, when you first are attracted to it, can seem impregnable. It even has answers, as many cults do, as many religions do, to the apparent contradictions. I mean, when you, for example, when you're a Marxist and somebody says to you, but look, most working class people don't think that that communism or that extreme state socialism is an answer to their problems. They prefer free markets. They prefer capitalism. They want to get on under their own resources and so on. And you say, I've got the answer to that. False consciousness.
Right.
Capitalism encourages people. It has an insidious way of encouraging people who are deeply disadvantaged, who will always be disadvantaged, to think that they are actually going to do better under a free market system. So in a sense, you have all the equipment that you need. You also have the dialectic procedure in Marxism is so like liturgy. It is so like a kind of catechism that you can learn when you're confronted with a question, you have the answer in the text. I can remember in far-left circles, which were very fissaporous, you know, and breaking up all the time, endless arguments, endless contradictions, apparently, that had to be resolved. You could always resolve them by going to the text. Mm-hmm. You could win the argument by saying, Marx said right here, and cite the chapter and verse, or in my case, because I was a Trotskyist, Trotsky said right here, and you've won the argument.
And what's fascinating about that, I think, is that the Marxist theory of history strongly resembles other theories and structures
yes.
of history. I mean, it's uncannily close. I mean,
yep.
look at in many fundamentalist Christian versions of the end of the world, there's an apocalyptic battle which is followed by the millennium. In Marxism,
yeah.
there's a revolution which is followed by
the temporary dictatorship
of the proletariat, which
yeah.
then passes into true
yeah.
socialism, which is actually
yeah.
the millennium.
Yeah.
And also the dialectic of Marxism owes an
yes.
awful lot to
it's very
the
19th,
dialectic of apocalyptic preachers
and also
in the Middle Ages.
Very 19th century, too. It's a very Hegelian, you know, and the Marxists don't like you to say that. You know, the process of sort of synthesis and antithesis and so on. It's very, there is a kind of deterministic quality. And Marxists don't like you to say that either because they deny that they're economic determinists. But there is a kind of progress itself is a force, is
yes.
an objective force driving you on to the ultimate state. And it's amazing how people who criticize the left and criticize Marxism who didn't know their Marx would fall foul of this. They would criticize early capitalism, entrepreneurial capitalism, in a way that Marx would never have done. He thought capitalism at that point was a liberating force because it liberated people from feudalism. So he had this sense that progress, historical progress, was a kind of inexorable movement.
Yes.
And we were moving from the feudal dictatorship through capitalism and bourgeois democracy to the ultimate true socialist state, which is
absolutely, and I think you can predate. If you go before Hegel, you'll find many theories of history in which there's the age of the father, the age of the son, the age yeah. of the Holy Ghost, and also the idea that the gospel will spread around the world, sometimes
yes.
in a particular direction. And the moment at which all peoples recognize the gospel
yep.
is the moment at
and
which the end times begin.
And yet there isn't complete agreement over what the gospel will be, because you yourself, as a Trotskyite, were the
yes.
product of a split, in the same way that the Reformation
yep.
split the Christian church.
The business
church,
about the global nature of that truth was very important to the Marxist
yeah.
split, because the Trotskyists always said it has to be world revolution. The whole world has to become socialist.
Yes.
And Stalinism was the heresy.
Socialism
because
in one
socialism
country.
In one country.
Yes.
So it was and very analogous to
do you
theology.
Think that the rise of Maoism in the 1960s particularly encourages splitting and cult-like behavior? There's something about...
Yeah, they were complete nutters.
They were complete nutters,
yeah,
but
yeah.
It was the natural product of Maoism itself, the rebellion against bureaucracy, the rebellion against the party and structure that goes hand in glove with postmodernism in the 60s, with various liberation movements with identity
yes,
politics to suggest
revolution.
You could define revolution for yourself.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean,
yeah, but let's not assume that the intrinsic violence of a political creed is what causes the splitting. I've been reading about the Amish recently, and you'll find that getting the little details right of how you should live according to traditions of your forefathers splits the Amish into so many different groups, and you see the same thing in the ultra-Orthodox Jewish world.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Damian Thompson and Janet Daly, thank you both very much. For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.